Welcome to the Fun Time Program. I'm your host, Vivica Volt, and this is my lovely co-host,
John Andrew Fredrickson.
And today, via Zoom, we have a very special guest that we're incredibly excited to talk to, Reverend Wendy Hamilton, who is a DC candidate for Congress, and she is also the spiritual and cultural director for the Andrew Yang campaign. So I guess our first question for you is, how did you get involved in politics and what got you involved with the Yang campaign?
So I'll give you the short version because otherwise we'll be here till tomorrow.
Of course.
We have all night.
Well, let me first say, you can't live in Washington, D.C. and not be involved in politics, directly or indirectly. Like,
right.
Even if you want to ignore it, if you sit down at a coffee shop to have a conversation, they're going to want to ask you about something around politics. So you have to have sort of a general knowledge, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
But for me, I didn't really get involved until college, I have to say. Okay. Growing up, we weren't really politically active per se. I grew up in a small town in Ohio called Portsmouth. Yes, I'm a Buckeye.
Hey, me too. I'm from Columbus. What's up?
See, my girl.
Oh, wait. Hey.
Ohio. So all my family, my brother, they're all in Columbus and Dayton, where my father's from. Yep. So we weren't really that involved in politics growing up, but I left Ohio to come to Howard University in Washington, D.C. That's like how I got to D.C.
Yeah.
H-U, right. You know. So,
hey.
So Howard is not just a college experience. It's a birth into activism. It is a birth into the political and generational struggles of African-American community. That's one of the benefits of attending a historically Black college and university.
Is I that was literally just about to ask. Yeah.
Yeah. You're not just coming. You might think you're coming to get your classes and your major, but they are going to ask you, what do you know about your heritage? What do you know about your history? Where mm-hmm. do you stand on this issue? Politics and our history is infused into every class. You're expected to participate. There's meetings and uprisings and activism. situations that happen on campus. When I was there, now I'm going to tell my age, but when I was there in my sophomore year, 1989, we were staging a protest on the campus because of some oppressive administrative policies, right?
You know, okay, so all right.
National politics, it was about, you know, all politics is local or about the school. So we had an activist group known as the Black NEA Force. And the All Black right. NEA Force staged a takeover of the administration building. And
wow.
So we stormed the building and held it for like 2 or 3 days until we had a list of demands to be met. I mean, and it got national coverage, like ABC News Tonight, Peter Jennings, who was, you know, at mm-hmm. that time.
Oh, like, oh, I remember Peter Jennings. Don't you forget? Okay.
So you're not that young. You do know Peter Jennings.
Exactly.
So now, you know, if you coming from Ohio, we didn't mm-hmm. stage protests and things like that. So this was like a whole new world for me.
Oh, no. I 100% stayed out of politics until I came to New York.
Listen, I came as this naive country girl from Ohio. I went home with Sister Soldier. Like, what's up?
Yep. You were like, I need my black beret. I need my glove. Like, where we at?
My mother was like, who are you and where is my child?
I love it.
Like, Mom, but you didn't tell me about the struggle. You know, I know about the struggle now.
And
I
right.
know, you know, so I have to say that's where my sort of political activism spirit of that was lit at Howard.
I love it.
If nothing else, it reinforced for me the importance of being connected and becoming involved and taking charge and understanding what's going on and noticing that you're not separate and apart from the things that are happening to you.
Right.
That you actively have an opportunity to have a voice in how things are being run or how things are being done. Mm-hmm. So it was Howard that kind of birthed me into that. And then, of course, after going to Howard Divinity School, feeling called to ministry and going to Howard School of Divinity. So, I, you know, Howard's so nice, I went twice.
Hey!
you know, from my theological perspective, I mostly identify with ministry and social justice.
Okay.
And for those who aren't necessarily familiar with the, I'll say with Christianity and Jesus' approach to taking care of the widow and looking out for the least of these and looking, out for the oppressed and the things that Jesus did when he was in the earth. I mean, Jesus was, telling the people, stop letting the religious leaders and the political leaders tell you what to do. Forget about the Pharisees and the Sadducees. You have the power on the inside of you. That's what I'm showing you. I need you to tap into that because I'm about to be out. And so I need you guys to step into the power that you have so that when I'm gone, they won't try to take control over you again. And so the powerful got upset about that and they had him killed. But that's a whole sermon that I'm not going to get into right now. Yep.
I mean, Jesus was the original socialist.
With the natural hair, but we're not going to go into that right now.
Exactly.
hair was not blonde, eyes were not blue, but
Lord. And he had a big old beard. Mm-hmm.
Talk about whitewashing.
Jesus.
That's where I'm at. Look, we had a picture. I don't know if you ever heard the group Ashford and Simpson. They were an older group, but Nick Simpson, he kind of looked like Black Jesus to me. So we had a picture of him on the wall. But that's all work.
That's better.
Mm-hmm. So when I got into ministry, I just transferred that energy into that, right? Into servant leadership, into looking out for, those who were oppressed. And so I gravitated toward, jobs and opportunities gave me a chance to do that. So I went to work at the NAACP national headquarters and, with being on the national level, our hands are in a little bit of everything. And I was the assistant to the president and CEO at that time, Ben Jealous. And so, with the, Troy Davis death penalty cases and Trayvon Martin, and, I was there when these kinds of things arose. And so it's just always been in me to do and always, in my spirit. So I volunteered with different campaigns and helped out. But in terms of being on staff for an actual campaign, that did not happen until I discovered Andrew Yang. And I literally discovered him in a sense that I opened up the newspaper one Sunday in 2018, and he had literally just filed, I opened up the New York Times to read, and there was this big, sort of introductory story called The Robots Were Coming article. Mm-hmm. The robots are coming. That got my attention, and it's introducing this young Asian gentleman who had just declared for the presidency and talked about his platform. And mainly it was talking, of course, about the fact that so many jobs had been automated away in the Midwest and that was a lot of the reason, behind why Donald Trump got elected and that those reasons weren't being addressed. And a lot of it was monetary. Automation was going to be accelerating and taking jobs away and people were falling through the cracks. They're feeling unheard and we need to do something in response. So how about a universal basic income of $1,000 a month to put into people's hands as a lifeline until, they can figure out, what their next move is going to be. And I'm sitting here like, did he say, let's remember the least of these and those who are struggling and give them something tangible? Not just a mouthful of promises that, may or may not, come to fruition. And wow, is he talking about the Midwest? Because that makes me think about my grandparents who worked in the shoe factory and the atomic plant who lost those good paying jobs due to automation or getting them shipped overseas. And man, $1,000 a month coming in for them back then would have made all the difference in the world because at least they would have known we've got something. Not to live on, but at least we're not dealing with zero. And we have something that can meet our needs until we figure out our next step. And and then he said, we need to do this. We need to start taking care of each other again and putting humanity first. And I'm like, he's preaching and don't know it. I'm like, he's talking about the stuff that I talk about on Sunday, just in a different way. I need to know who this guy, I'm with him. This campaign, I don't care, because I need to be moved by a candidate. I need to connect to you. I don't,
Me too.
He was one of the first ones you know, he was one of the first ones in. I didn't wait until, you know, like later on, you know, Kamala got in and Cory Booker and some people like, you're not going to support the black woman. You're not going to support the black man and all that. Love them. Think they're great. Kamala went to Howard. But that's not why. That's not why I select candidates. That's not what moves me to select somebody. I need to be able to rest because I need to be able to support you authentically. And this man is speaking to my soul. And so I'm going to help him. And so I literally, they had the campaign address and I wrote an email and introduced myself and said, you know, I'm in D.C. If you're in New York, if you come to D.C., I'd love to meet you and, you know, help volunteer, set something up. And the campaign wrote back and said, yeah, of course we're going to be coming to D.C. And then like 10 minutes later, Andrew wrote back. And I was like,
wow.
Oh, wow.
You know, it was like Andrew at Gmail or something. I'm like,
right. Like, is that a staffer or? Right.
And he was like, no, Reverend Wendy, thank you so much. You get it. You know, would love to, you know, meet and talk. I was like, oh, okay. You know, so he really is different, right?
And, okay. And
about 3 months later, he came down to DC and met with a group of us. Like, you know, we call ourselves, you know, the early adopters, if you will, about six or seven of us. And I started volunteering and traveling a little bit with the campaign. Then I would just go up and introduce him and like at rallies in Baltimore, things like that. But then later actually formally joined the staff. So that's my Yang story.
I love it. That is such a wonderful introduction to politics in general. And especially just like kind of accidentally falling into the Andrew Yang campaign.
That's
beautiful.
That to me, you know, is sort of the synchronicity of it all. That's the way I like to look at things. You know, it's kind of like, yeah, I fell into it, but at the end of the day, when I look back and connect the dots, it's kind of like that was the direct.
It was a straight line, yeah.
Because you look back, oh, now it makes sense why I did this and that. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
So was it your experience in the Andrew Yang campaign that inspired you to then run for Congress now? Or is this something you've been thinking about for a while? What was your inspiration behind that decision?
Good question. And yes, I would have to say ultimately it was my experience directly with the Andrew Yang campaign that solidified my decision. I've always entertained it or mused about it. And you know, you always have people, you should run for, you know, you should be great. And I'm like, thank you, but that takes more than a notion. That's not something you just you know, wake up and say, you know what?
There's some money involved.
I mean, even Andrew would say on the trail that he didn't wake up one day and say, you know what, I'm going to run for president. He said, because I'm not insane. I mean, I'm not insane. Yeah. He was like, you know what this undertaking something like this means, you know, and what it requires if you're going to do it. And, you know, from that place of commitment and dedication. And it's not just something that you're doing to build your resume and all of that kind of stuff. So I said all that to say, over the years, you know, the thought might have crossed my mind or people suggested, but I never seriously entertained it. But after having worked directly with the campaign and kind of being in there and seeing how the sausage is made, it made me a little bit more comfortable with the idea of it. But it really wasn't until this past summer when John Lewis was dying and C.T. Vivian died and all these civil rights, you know, leaders who had made so much progress were dying. And we were still, you know, being held hostage by an administration that was hostile to all of that progress at the time. And I was sitting here in my kitchen, you know, and I was just kind of like, I cannot even physically get my mind around the possibility of four more years of this. I know we won't make it as a country. I don't think. I'll make it, you know, because at that time we didn't know how the, you know, the election was going to turn out.
We did not know.
And so I said, I really prayed and I was, you know, and I really got this sense that, you know, God was kind of like, so are you going to tuck tail and run? You going to stand up and fight?
Amen.
Well, you know, I'm a fighter. So.
Yep. Here we are.
I put it out there on social media, you know, just kind of mused about it. I said, you know, with all these things happening, you know, I have a right mind to run for Congress, you know, and you expect a few people to say, oh, you can do it, Rev. Wendy, you know, go for it.
Of course.
I was not ready, you know, for just the amount of response and support. It humbled me, you know, when people were like, I'll help you. And so the response in and of itself made me think that, well, maybe this isn't just amusing, you know, maybe I need to to think about this a little bit more. Like,
nice.
I put it out there, but this might be a possibility. And so ultimately, and I reached out, talked to a few folks, people that I know, and ultimately made the decision to run and put my hat in the ring. So here I am. Wow.
That is so inspiring.
I love hearing that. I'm actually curious, why did you choose Congress specifically and not something like the Senate or something a little bit more local, especially since you had had experience with local politics at Howard?
So the local politics that I had experience with were really kind of relegated, if you will, to sort of higher education and the
things. Okay, so academia,
You know, in academia and in that space, although we would sometimes participate in marches. I mean, the Million Man March and stuff came around that time. Right. And, you know, so there were things that would happen because, you know, there's a protest in D.C. every week. If you want to march every week with somebody, somebody is marching.
Wow. You'll get your exercise in one way or the other. Get that cardio. You know,
we don't really trip when there's these big marches or protests that are happening. Wow. Like, this is what we do. You know what I'm saying?
Because so, in New York City, we have parades every week, but it's usually around either drinking or some other cultural thing.
It's at least once a month. It's like once a month.
Right.
Some sort of con. Santa con.
some excuse to drink, usually.
Pretty much. Okay. Well, ours is some excuse to call the government, you know, into account for some atrocity that they have done. So
honestly, there's a lot of atrocities. Yes. So we got to keep their feet to that fire.
Right. And the World Bank is here. IMF is here, you know,
right.
So it's not even always just directed to Capitol Hill. You know, you got international organizations here.
Sure.
All the countries have an embassy here.
Yes.
So, you know, there's always something to get involved in. But for me, it was more kind of local. I didn't really start to get the national exposure until I worked for NAACP and start getting involved on that level. And so that is why I ultimately decided on Congress because, well, you know, someone said when I started thinking about running here, they said, well, what about city council or what about mayor? And I'm like, I'm not an administrator. I know that's not my gift. You know what I'm saying? I would not do well in managing the police budget and the fire off. You know, you have to know your lane, right?
Right.
Yes.
And my gift is in advocacy. My gift is in speaking out and up and behalf, and that's what you do from a federal standpoint. I couldn't run for Senate because we're not a state.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
All right. No. So this comes right back to DC statehood.
No representation.
I brought that back around.
Tricky.
But no, I'm glad that you pointed that out because that also kind of factored into my decision, right? So once I made the decision that I feel like my voice could be best utilized and my experience level from a congressional standpoint, I thought, but DC, we're not a state yet. And so I can't vote on anything. And do I really want to put together a campaign and go through all of this just to get to the Hill and still not be able to vote on it?
Right.
So what exactly can a representative from DC, it's one representative from DC, right? In Congress.
We have one non-voting delegate. Yes. And
so what does that non-voting delegate do then?
You can write bills.
Okay.
You can sit on committees. You can do everything you possibly, you can put your voice on the record. Uh-huh. You just vote. So even like the current statehood bills that are in the House, our current delegate wrote it, but she couldn't vote on it.
Oh my goodness.
So wow.
She's like going around and getting the sponsors, the co-sponsors, because, you know, and all that in the House, and she can do all of that. But when it comes to the actual vote, can't vote on it.
Do you know what the history of that is? Was there always a representative from D.C. or is that a newer thing?
So in 1976 is when they established the D.C. non-voting delegate position. And we have had two in that role since 1976. Walter Fontenot, who was there from 1976 to 1991.
Wow.
And he left to go run for mayor. And then our current delegate, Eleanor Holmes Norton, who has been there since 1991. She's been there for 30 years.
Oh, no. Oh, no, no, no. This is where term limits need to be a thing. This is ridiculous.
Is she running for re-election
years?
In 2022?
We don't know yet. But at the same time, what I am telling people is Eleanor Holmes Norton is, you know, she's got a legacy here. You know, she's got a reputation, and you will not hear me say anything negative about her. I will not campaign like that. She is my elder, and I respect that. I tell people I'm not running against Eleanor Holmes Norton. I'm running for DC. And so that is where my focus is going to be. So she has not officially filed. I don't know, you know, if she is going to run again, but I'm running. And so
that's all that matters.
As it stands right now, she's, you know, she's who we're assuming is going to be, you know, the challenger. But and if it turns out that she makes a decision to retire or what have you, then we will adjust accordingly. But right now, we're running the campaign. She's holding the seat. So that's who we're assuming is going to run again. But we are focusing on establishing our message, because one of the things about statehood, and I know we're going to get into that, but let me just say this about it. And it's, again, part of what motivated me to run is anybody who runs for any kind of office here in D.C. is expected to champion and stand for statehood, which is important. But what has happened, in my opinion, is that it has taken up so much air in the room that no one seems to be talking about what happens beyond statehood. Like, once we get statehood, then what? What do you want me to say? What's our voice? What's our message? What policies are we going to be advocating for once we become a state? You know, yes, get statehood. Yeah, but then what? You don't wait till you get what you want to prepare to have it. You prepare ahead of time so that when you get it, you are ready. You understand what I'm saying? So my message is more along statehood and beyond. Okay, we're a state now. So here's what I need for my state. I'm going to need universal basic income. I'm going to need universal health care. I'm going to need us to look at the criminal justice system to, you know, to figure out what we're going to do about reallocating some of this police budgets so that we can get some more community partnerships in, because I feel like clergy and social workers and psychologists can respond to some of these 911 calls. Everything does not require a legal and lethal response. You know, so let's go ahead and
just be out here. I know you're a preacher, but I'm your choir over here, and I appreciate you.
I'm gonna step down in a minute.
Oh no, you stay up there, because you were just saying everything I love to fucking hear. Like, you could say, like, my favorite things, my favorite political terms to hear: overturn Citizens United and defund the police.
Right.
So, and then if we can throw abolish ICE in there too, ooh.
That's a sweet spot for you. So I'm saying all that to say, I feel like I have a message that will resonate, because as a result of the focus mainly being on statehood, what we have found and what the data shows, because, you know, you can't work for Andrew Yang and not understand data and apply that to how you run your race. So in looking at the numbers, it shows that, you know, turnout has decreased over time. People have become disengaged and disillusioned because they're kind of like,
it makes total sense.
What's the point? Yeah. You know, like we come out, we vote for the same thing. Nothing has changed. So why participate?
Right. There needs to be issues on the ballot as well. When you're thinking about your candidates, you need to be inspired by them about how we can change things in Congress, not just around one issue, but around all these issues that are important to us.
Right. Because you go into, I go into the city, you know, and I go and talk to residents, and they can't really tell, you know, like, if I say to them, how would us getting statehood impact your daily life here? Or, you know, because it's got to be more than a slogan, right? So they know we want statehood. Yeah. But in order for you to feel motivated to come out and vote, the voter is going to need to know, how does us getting statehood impact my individual life? You know, what, why should I go out and vote for you? And it's like, for me, it's like, because if we are and become a state, then these policies that can directly impact your life, we can start advocating for those and making sure that DC receives their allocation and you know, and my voice, and that, you know, my voice more than anything else. That's why I said I'm going to go ahead and run for this position, because until I can get a vote, they gonna hear my voice.
You know what I'm
saying? So even if you can get your voice on the record, I felt like that was, you know, enough, you know, to be able to feel like the DC voices were being represented, reflected, and heard. So that's part of why I went ahead and decided to go for it.
That's amazing.
I love everything about this, obviously. I love seeing, obviously, Black representation in all facets of the government, but especially in higher facets of the government, like the Senate mm-hmm. and the Congress as well. I'm just so mm-hmm. excited to see people like you who are pushing a progressive agenda, not just for DC statehood, but obviously for the nation in general. Right. And I think that having more Congress people who are driven and have a clear-cut goal of how they want to push the nation is super yeah. important.
Were you inspired at all by the freshman class of 2018 in Congress? Do you remember the squad and a little bit?
just a tiny bit?
just a tiny. Well, let me say, of course I was inspired by them, but then mm-hmm. when I started entertaining the idea of running, now I'm going back and I'm looking at the documentary that they did and I'm like, yeah. okay, well, let me, I think, what was it called? Bringing Down in the House? Mm-hmm. I can't even think of the name off the top of my head, but, mm-hmm. You know, they did a documentary and they followed AOC and Cori Bush and two mm-hmm. other young ladies. It's on Netflix and it documented their 2018 runs.
Yeah.
From the beginning. And I went back and I watched that because I wanted to understand what inspired these women who mm-hmm. were, you know, unknowns.
Your average everyday woman.
Novices that decided they were going to go run up against 30-year incumbents, you know?
Right.
So
right.
I had a, you know, like a kindred sort of spirit, like, let me draw from them. And so after watching that documentary, it helped to shape and to ground me. It was sobering, you know, watching what they went through. I mean, right. AOC ultimately was the only one who won that year. But of course, Cori Bush turned around and came back.
Yes, right. She did.
Yeah, it was AOC, Cori Bush, Paula Jean Swearingen from mm-hmm. West Virginia, mm-hmm. and one other young lady.
Amy Villela? Of Nevada?
Yeah, Jean Valet, yeah, from Nevada. That's right.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It was called Knock Down the House on Netflix.
I said Bring Down the House, but that's Queen Latifah and Steve Martin.
And I'm going to go ahead and say, I rewatched that movie like last year in like 2019 with my little cousin because she was born like that year. And so like for her, it's like her comfort movie. I rewatched this and I was like, I need to call Queen Latifah right now because I'm going to snatch her black card up. What is this? That movie was so offensive. I was like, okay, so this is just a minstrel show. Like, y'all just put on a minstrel show. Yeah, okay, here. I know. This was 2000 fucking three.
Yeah. It's like, amazing how much our perspectives have changed. Jesus. We watched Aladdin. I grew up without Disney, and so she's been introducing me to Disney movies, and we're both sitting here like...
Not 3 minutes into the movie, he looks at me and he goes, is this cultural appropriation? I was like, no, baby, this is just racist. Like, this is just racist.
You know, stuff that we grew up with that it never crossed our minds that this isn't really appropriate the way that mm-hmm. that they're depicting, you know, people from around the world in different cultures. And we didn't even have that awareness yet. I mean, sure, people did have that awareness, but it wasn't right. widespread enough in culture. Whereas, and maybe I've just evolved as a person, that's entirely possible, but I think that society has also evolved.
Oh, absolutely. In that time. I mean, if you look back,
a combination of the two.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Let me going back to Knocking Down the House.
Of course. You
know, I was inspired, like I said, because all of the ladies were taking on somebody that yep. was, you know,
an incumbent. Yeah.
Now, I also say I felt a sort of kinship, especially with Cori Bush, in mm-hmm. a sense, you know, not just that she was a Black woman, but she also is a minister in her background yep. and nurse. And she literally went from, you know, activism on the street of Ferguson mm-hmm. to I'm yep. going to run for office. And yep. she faced, and she was running against Lacey Clay mm-hmm. Jr., who... The Clays were like political Black royalty in St. Louis, Missouri. Like okay. his dad had held the seat for 20 years and then the son held the seat. So they were like a dynasty.
Yeah.
And they were like really coming after her. Like you have the audacity to run after the Clays, you know, seat or whatever, mm-hmm. you know, and even someone said to me a couple of weeks ago, when they were asking about my race and they were like, now what are you running for again? And I said, you know, I'm running for DC delegate. They was like, you're running for Eleanor Holmes Norton's seat? I said, I'm running for the people's seat.
Right. This doesn't belong to any particular person.
You understand? Yeah. I don't care how long. That's the people. See, the people decide who's in that. She's like, oh yeah, I hear you. I hear. But no, I need to correct that, because sometimes we think that. And so like in Missouri, they, you know, how dare you? That's the clay seat. They've been the only ones that held. It doesn't belong to them.
Right.
And so they actually, you know, ran quite a negative campaign against Corey, because I wondered how this Black man was going to position himself against this young Black woman.
Oh, right. Wow. Especially a Black woman who had such a specific face and name in the Ferguson protests.
Listen, I saw a flyer produced by his campaign that sent out on her talking about how could, you know, a nurse file bankruptcy and
ooh, can you no, that is.
I was like, oh, are you doing that for real?
Oh, that's what we doing today? Yeah. Okay. And karma gonna come for you, sir.
Listen, you know, all that did was, you know, inspire the women who've been through bankruptcy and stuff all to get out the vote for her. Like, oh, right. You talking about us.
Yep. Last time I checked, God don't like ugly.
Yeah. So I really, you know, resonated with her story. And you know, even though she lost, I was very moved by her coming back, you know, not letting that keep her down and coming back in 2020 and ultimately winning. So yes, that is the inspiration that I have received from these young women that have really sort of propelled me into continuing to move forward, even when people are saying, are you sure? Mm-hmm. You know? Mm.
So what you're saying is you're really excited to join the squad?
Listen, ready.
Hey.
Ready.
That's what I heard. I'm hearing you just ready to join your friends.
Yeah, exactly. Let's get up and make this thing happen, because, you know, we're all about the people. It's time out for 2020 politics. We're in the 21st century now. I mean, you know, for the old way of doing things, the status quo just isn't working. And so there's a thing about timing too. Mm-hmm. And I think that the timing is ripe right now for change, where people are saying, we got to do things differently. The way we've been doing things, and folks who have been in these offices and in these seats for years, God bless them, but let them move on so that the torch can be passed and new energy can start to flow.
Yes.
Amen. And at the end of the day, even just having competitive elections rather than a single person running unopposed for years, it reinvigorates the conversation in the community, and it gets people inspired to get involved in thinking about these issues rather than just saying Joe Crowley's going to run again and nobody's running against him. And so, you know, he's going to do what Crowley does and I don't even really know what he does, but hey, he's my representative. So why do I need to vote? You know what I mean? And then AOC comes along. She's like, actually, we have a chance to do something about these issues. So come and talk, you know, come and get involved in, you know, thinking about these things and galvanizing people. And every time somebody stands up like Cori Bush and all these other people and runs against the incumbents and people like yourself, it's not saying that, hey, necessarily we hate you as an incumbent. It's just that, like, having conversation around these issues is healthy and important, and may the best person win, and the more we have, you know, fresh blood coming in with new ideas, more we inspire more people to get involved in politics, because they say, hey, somebody's talking about these ideas that weren't previously being talked about and those speak to me, and now I'm going to get involved in my politics. So it's so healthy for our democracy to have that. So yeah, we're so thankful for people like you who are bringing this joy to the table. You bring such joy to these issues. It's wonderful.
Listen, I'm a hope dealer. Have you not seen my merch?
I love it. We have.
that's my little sticker. But that's what my merch says.
I'm a hope higher.
It's a little thing. It says hope dealer on it. I don't know if you can see it.
Perfect. Perfect.
Okay. I love that.
Because what I also feel like is that the city, because of that dissolution, they've lost hope. You know, coupled with the pandemic and everything else that's happening, you know, folks are looking to be inspired again. Folks are looking to want to hope and believe that something can change, that there could be a possibility that things could be different. And that's what you want. Like you were saying earlier, democracy thrives when as many people are involved as possible.
Yes, exactly.
People staying home and becoming disillusioned and disengaged and stuff is what allows for democracy to stagnate and to not grow. And so if I were an incumbent, I would welcome more voices into the conversation, you know, right. And say, hey, like you said, it made the best person win or what have you. But the more people are in there, the more then we have to have these conversations. It's your challenge to have these conversations and earn your vote, not just assume you're going to get it because you've always gotten it.
Andrew Yang inspired me so much because that's how he always talked about his run for presidency. He's like, at the end of the day, it's not about me winning or not. It's about having these conversations. It's about bringing these ideas to the national conversation and making sure that whoever does eventually win has heard these arguments and is ready for them and can bring them to whatever seat they're running for because they're aware that a large part of their constituency voted for somebody who was advocating for these issues. You know what I mean? So, and that's if we can get more people thinking like that, we can get more people inspired to run. And I think we can really reinvigorate involvement in politics, especially local politics. That is so awesome. What do you see as your biggest challenge then in this race?
Well, I do think that, you know, because of name recognition on Eleanor Holmes Norton's part, that's going to be a hill that I'm going to have to climb. I mean, I have my relationships. DC, I consider my adult home. I came when I was 17 years old to go to Howard. So even though I was born in Ohio, DC is where I grew up. You understand what I'm saying? DC is where I came of age, and everything that happened to me here has you know, lent and shaped the woman that I have become. And I love this city, you know, and in addition to ministry and the church work that I've done and the social advocacy work, I've also worked at DC Public Schools for the last 7 years as an attendance counselor, where I work with families who struggle with truancy issues and absenteeism, and helping them overcome those obstacles. And it's really like ministry too, right? Because you're working directly with families. You know, all ministry doesn't happen behind a pulpit. Most of it happens out in the marketplace. And so, you know, having the opportunity to pull on my ministry skills to help them, like, you know, earlier today, you know, I got noticed that one of our students who hadn't been coming to school, we're still doing virtual learning here in DC. And some schools are doing hybrid where the kids might come in 1-2 days a week, but we're moving back, transitioning toward bringing them in. But, you know, got a notice this morning that one of our eighth grade students was probably not going to be coming to school for a while because his father passed away and that it was traumatic because he was found dead in the home and it was the student that found him.
That's the worst.
It's just... You know, and just the sweetest person, the sweetest family. You know, the father was so very involved in the son's life. I mean, I probably have worked with the father more than mom, just because she worked and dad was the one that, like, his primary. So being the son and finding your father, I mean, that's a that's a lot of trauma to have to process.
Especially
and so
if you had a good relationship with your father like that too.
Yeah. And so we've got children who are really struggling with a lot of issues before they ever even get to the classroom. Right. And so this experience has sort of ingratiated me into the DC community in ways that a lot of people, you know, haven't had the opportunity to do, because I've had to work directly with families. I've had to go to court with parents who, you know, were being threatened with losing their children to the foster care system because of educational neglect. So I've had to work with the agencies and become familiar with what resources are available to our families and you know, those kinds of things. And so I love this city. And I feel like because of that relationship, I can then authentically represent the voice of DC residents on the Hill. And the other thing was that, and I don't know if you guys got a chance to see our new ad that we dropped today, but
no, not yet.
Yeah,
we will absolutely be linking it, though.
Can we run it at the end of the show or even during the show?
Oh, absolutely.
Amazing.
I've already put it out there. I mean, it's on Twitter. It's on all
Fantastic.
Of
our.
Perfect. We'll include it at the end of the episode for everyone to watch.
Awesome.
But one thing that happens often, particularly in the national conversation, is people want to make disparaging remarks about Washington and lump us, the DC residents, in with what's going on with Washington. And we're always like, stop maligning Washington. You know, because there's 700,000 of us who have lives and things that we care about. And we are separate and apart from what's happening on Pennsylvania Avenue. Right. We have 700,000 residents. We have 8 wards here in DC. multicultural, vibrant, eclectic. We go to work, we pay our bills, you know. Six, of course, it you know, it did concern us, but that's downtown. That's not right. happening uptown. Everybody's still going to work. You know, we're trying to do what we need to do.
So I think that there might actually be quite a bit of ignorance on this topic nationally, is that people just don't really understand that DC really is its own city. They think of DC as just being sort of the government hub that's on the border of Maryland and Virginia. And did I get that right?
Showing
my ignorance here.
No,
I've exactly actually been there.
And that's so, the federal district, and that is in Ward 6.
There's
right. seven wards that are full of people that aren't even connected to anything that's happening down on Pennsylvania Avenue.
So what is the process then to actually getting DC statehood passed? Because as we know, there's this unfortunate wrinkle involved that means that by giving you two seats in the Senate, those seats would most likely go blue, right? Mm-hmm. It's assumed. And that means that one party is not going to want to vote for it because they'd essentially be giving potential control of the Senate to the Democrats.
Which how we already have.
How do we over... Right, but I mean, they're making it more difficult for them to win control, I mean, giving up two seats. How do we get past that particular wrinkle? Because that seems like it's a tough hill to climb.
I mean, they could just change their campaigns.
Well, I mean, yeah, right. Realistically.
That sounds like a them problem.
Not idealistically. Well, it's an us problem because we need their votes, don't we? What is the what do we need? Like how do you get this bill passed? Oh, okay. This is sorry.
So let's talk about a perfect case scenario, but the argument that you just made is the one that grieves me the most because at the end of the day, you know, and Mitch McConnell ultimately articulated that he said the quiet part out loud. See, for years,
which he does a lot more these days.
Yeah, that's interesting. So
for years, they used to try to make the statehood issue about DC being incompetent and unable to manage and govern ourselves needing to have this congressional oversight, you know, which had a whole bunch of racist overtones because at the time, you know, DC. And still, even though we're no longer majority Black, which we were back in the day at one time, you know, DC was almost 80% Black. They called us Chocolate City. Now, that was our nickname. Now we're Mocha. You know, we're about
got a little cream in there.
Little latte going on, but you know, but still one of the largest plurality of Black residents, you know, for a metropolitan city in the country. And so when we started, you know, the mayor started balancing budgets and our numbers started looking good, then it was like, now what's your argument about statehood? Because they have demonstrated now that they are fiscally responsible and can make decisions. So now Mitch said, well, you know, what it actually is, is we can't let them get statehood because they're going to get two more Democratic seats in the Senate and we can't have that.
And let's be real. We knew that at the end of the day, that was really the only real politic thing happening here. And everything else was kind of just explanations to justify that.
Exactly. So my thing is this, first of all, you can't stop something that's inevitable, first and foremost. So you can delay it, but this whole fear even that you had about the Democrats regaining control of the Senate just happened to you in Georgia. So while you were trying to stop, you know, and I know we still have to defend those seats and hold on to it, but the fact is eventually there will be a Democratic majority in the Senate. So why don't we just look at the statehood issue on its merit? Not from a political standpoint, but can we at least from a patriotic standpoint suggest that it is unconstitutional to deny voting rights to over 700,000 individuals who pay taxes yet have no representation? They've got more population than the state of Wyoming and Vermont, yet both of those states have two senators representing them. So it's not like we don't necessarily, we do have representation in the House with a seat like that I'm running for,
but
we
have nothing in the Senate. You don't have a vote.
Right. But we don't have Senate representation.
Right.
And so how do we get it? Well, if things were, you know, equitable and people were, you know, not acting from a political place, the idea would be to get it passed in the House, which it passed in the House for the first time last June. Okay.
Okay.
So
We're on the first step.
Really excited because for the first time we got the House, yeah, the vote for statehood passed. Boom.
How many votes did it?
It's 218.
It only requires a simple majority in the House to pass?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And is it the same in the Senate? It only needs a simple majority?
No. That's the rub. You need 50. You need 60.
Why?
You know, well, that's you know, the general passage rule is that you have to have, you know, 60 votes in order for a floor vote to be brought, unless you are going to do a, abolishing the filibuster.
Right. You know,
If we abolish the filibuster, then it would only require a simple majority, and we would have that with the 51st vote.
But that
would require folks being willing to do that.
Now, isn't there one vote per or one bill per session that they're?
Yeah, so they're in the process of rewriting the House bill again. Mm-hmm. And then they're going to try to, you know, I've been watching, you know, and so I think I saw where Delegate Norton is up to maybe like 211 sponsors right now. And then Senator Tom Carper of Delaware introduced the Senate bill. And the last time I checked, it had 39 signatures. Now, there's another thing on that, too. So in an ideal world, it would be bipartisan. It would be 50 Democratic senators, 10 Republican senators, and it would be brought to the floor, and you know, we would get the vote, and statehood would be done. Mm-hmm. But realistically, that's not looking like it, you know, it's going to come to pass. So these other conversations around abolishing the filibuster, I even read something about a carve out. I have to learn more about that, but that there's some kind of carve out you can do where you can just present statehood as like a standalone issue and do a simple majority, but I'm not exactly sure all the dynamics in that. But I think the current expectation is that we need to push for the possible abolishing of the filibuster, because that as it stands right now, that'd be about the only way that we could get it across the goal line. But here's this too. That will require all of the Democratic senators, and you would think they would all be on, right?
You would think, right?
But there's a couple that's wavering. Joe Manchin, Kyrsten Sinema, you know, that aren't quite sure if they're going to sign on to. I'm like,
how did you get a Democratic seat if you aren't sure if you're going to do Democratic shit?
You ever been to West Virginia?
I've been to West Virginia. I have, in fact, been to West Virginia. I'm not going back.
Then you understand a little bit more of what type of Democrat Joe Manchin is and what type of Democrat you need to be to win in West Virginia. So that does make things a little bit more difficult for us. But you do think that there is some hope for this bill?
There's always going to be hope. And at the end of the day, listen, if it winds up that we just have to start winning more Democratic seats and we just get 60 Democrat votes and we can just ourselves, that would be the bomb, right?
So that's
my hope. Like, if y'all want to keep, you're not going to stop what is meant to be. So, you know, if all these little, you know, sort of roadblocks you're trying to throw up in there, we're eventually going to find a way around. DC statehood is inevitable. So either you do it now voluntarily, or you're going to do it involuntarily, but it's going to happen.
And that's amazing. That's I love that message. You're inspiring hope in the process, because I think a lot of people that have looked into DC statehood that may have advocated for it in the past that definitely agree and are on board with it, maybe they feel the hope has kind of come out of the sails a little bit. So hearing you speak about it in those terms is really inspiring. And I really look forward to you continuing to hammer that point home, because people need to hear that. And they need to hear these arguments for why it's important that DC has statehood, and hear them on the national stage as well, because not enough people in other states are hearing that, you know?
Well, I will say, and there are huge pushes and wonderful organizations, DC Vote 51 for 51, that are pushing these messages, going to state houses around the country, because this isn't just a DC issue. We need folks in Iowa calling their senators and letting them know. And so many people are kind of unaware of the DC statehood issue and the fact that we aren't a state. They don't really, like we were saying early, understand about DC having a city that's separate and apart with what's happening in Washington. But let me also say this, that in championing the message, it has come to the forefront again in light of what happened on January the 6th.
Yes. Yes.
Right? We were hamstrung and couldn't even call the National Guard to protect ourselves because we got to go through the government to get our own residents covered. And Mayor Ballinger, she actually requested National Guard support 3 days before the 6th and was denied.
Wow.
Then, so on January 3rd, she had put it in and was denied the backup. And then when all hell broke loose on the 6th, she's still calling and couldn't get any response from the administration. And it's like our city, I mean, she was able to dispatch like the DC Metropolitan Police to kind of go give some backup, but we had to wait phone calls back and the Secretary of the Army and the Pentagon and all these other, we had to go through all these layers just for DC to ask permission for our residents to be protected. And that's just unacceptable.
Yeah.
So that has thrust the statehood conversation back to the forefront, even in a sense that Mayor Bowser, you know, has called upon, you know, Joe Biden to put statehood in his first 100 days agenda to look at so that we don't find ourselves in that situation again. So if you're looking in the news these days, there is a lot of talk around that because of what happened. But the key and the goal is keeping it in the news so that it doesn't, you know, fade away. And the way to do that is just to keep the conversation and get people beyond DC, talking about it as well.
Exactly. That's amazing.
Do you think that pushing the statehood for DC is going to push the national conversation for getting statehood for Puerto Rico as well?
Well, you know, I think there are times when they will join the two. People will say, you know, statehood for DC and for Puerto Rico. Right. I'm not sure about the numbers. I can only speak for DC. You know, 86% of DC residents, you know, in a recent poll are for statehood.
Right.
Puerto Rico's not so much. You know, some want it, some don't. So
it's like Puerto Rico, their government has been hamstrung because they're not quite a state, but they're also not quite an annexed like Providence. They're kind of their own country, but kind of part of our country. So they have representation, the same as the U.S. Virgin Islands, but they have no say, which they're getting taxed to shit. And we were supposed to step in and help with like Hurricane Maria. And here we are leaving them out to dry.
They got paper towels. I saw that.
Yeah, you just feel paper towels get thrown across.
You know what? You're right. You're right. That actually, those paper towels actually fixed their receiver, their big, what was it? The big radio.
Arecibo?
No. The radio radio receiver that got broken.
Arecibo.
Is that Arecibo?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Lord. Well, anytime that conversation comes up, I often hear people say, we'll let the people of Puerto Rico decide what they want. Like, they're not wanting people to come over there and start crusading for them and telling them, you know, but just kind of going based on what they want and responding to their conversations around statehood. And so theirs are a little bit different than ours.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
I obviously they're two different situations, but I think that from like a typical person perspective, like your average person, I think putting DC statehood in the average American mind will also get the average American thinking about, okay, well, if we can just add states, why can't we add Puerto Rico? Why can't we add Guam? Why can't we add these other like...
Right. And those are the conversations that have to happen because there really is no sort of, in my mind, logical reason why not.
Right.
It's most of them are purely political.
Well, there's not a logical reason. I mean, it's part of our country's DNA. If we wanted to aspire to the best of what, you know, of the ideas of our founders, taxation without representation was the whole reason this country was founded. we had a tea party. You know what I mean? Like
I recall the Brits being very upset about some tea in a harbor.
Like last I checked, conservatives are all about the founding fathers and how great our country is and how important these issues are. And it's like, well, if you care about that stuff, okay, DC's a state.
Right. Oh, so you mean so people, holding people to their own ideals is a thing?
People just need Are you talking about
practicing what you preach, walking the walk and not just talking the talk? Are you talking about integrity? Wait a minute, hold on.
That's the word.
I'm hearing integrity.
What's that word again? Let me look that one up. I love it. Yeah. DC statehood. We need to keep fighting this fight. Let's talk a little bit more about some of your other, you know, amazing policy proposals, because you really go in deep on your website. You know, it's not just about statehood for DC. Yeah. There's so many other important things, not just to your community, but also to the nation at large that you are an advocate for. So what would you say is your most, your number one, the one thing that gets you most excited on your passion project,
if you will,
in your policies?
After statehood?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Universal basic income. What?
Okay. Tell us about that.
Universal basic income. Where do I start? you know, of course, Andrew, it's not Andrew's original idea. Let's start there. And we all know that Martin Luther King championed a guaranteed income.
Absolutely, he fucking did.
Matter of fact,
Fred Hampton was all about that shit.
If his book, like, hold on, since I got my prop right here.
Yeah. Right. Yes. You know. Ooh, here, take it back from the screen just a little bit.
Pull it back a little bit so we can read the text.
I don't know if you can read it.
All right, nope. To your left. Left.
That way. Yeah, right there.
Perfect.
The solution to poverty is to abolish it directly by a now widely discussed measure, the guaranteed income. Martin Luther King Jr.
Yes. Mm-hmm. He was speaking about getting money into people's hands the night before he was assassinated.
That's right.
Yes, he absolutely was. About
King's dream, we're not going to just limit it to the content of our character, but we're going to talk about what he was trying to do on the behalf of poor people and what he was trying to do to hold us to the ideals of the country that we said that we were going to be. And that was putting money in people's hands. He said, we have mastered production in this country. Now we need to look at mastering distribution. You understand what I'm saying? So in that spirit, I feel like at the very least in the richest country in the world, the very least we can do is take care of our people and provide a way for our citizens to thrive. It's not about a handout. UBI is a help out. We used to help each other in this nation. And we don't need to worry about, well, will this create a negative effect? It doesn't matter. It has been demonstrated that the reason and the root of poverty is lack of cash. It's not lack of motivation.
And poverty is 100%. A fabricated problem.
Yes. So what is the number one
money what is in their hands? They'll spend it. Yes.
That's right. What is the number one pushback that you get from people? What's the biggest hurdle that people have when you're talking to them about universal basic income?
How are we going to pay for it?
Oh, I'm sorry. We could just take the tiniest bit of the military spending and we can pay for it.
What's your favorite proposal for paying for it? How do we pay for the tax breaks that we've given to, you know, multiple corporations and
that's right.
I mean, can we get some of them dollars? Just a couple.
About to say, because like I know a lot of corporations that use their tax dollars to put money in their CEO's pockets
and they don't get lazy,
but somehow the actual workers on the ground floor didn't see any of that money, and yet they still talking about how we still broke though.
Did you see Elon Musk tweeted when he became officially the richest person in the world? Did you see what he tweeted? Yeah. He wrote, well, better get back to work.
Time to go back to work. Yeah. But I mean, it's just ludicrous on its face to somehow suggest that people are going to kick back and stop being productive because you give them $15. I mean, it's not like we're saying, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Look at the arguments going back and forth about the unemployment and how much unemployment. We are in a pandemic. Mm-hmm. People love this. This is not a precedented type of situation. We should be all bets are off the table. We should be emptying the treasury to help our people survive.
That's what this is supposed to be for.
Yes, that's what, you know, rainy day funds and all this other kind of stuff we got laying around. And even when they started putting the money out there for small business loans, remember the PPE program?
Yeah.
That it turns out, you know, the Staples Center and Boeing and different multi-million dollar corporations.
Didn't Jared Kushner?
Now, how, right.
Didn't Jared Kushner get a
loan? All these not so small businesses get these right. small business loans?
Help it didn't make them lazy, how, did it?
How did Kanye West get right. a PPP loan?
Right. What the fuck was Kanye West doing? Oh, I'm sorry. His Yeezy shoes weren't selling in the pandemic, so he needed a fucking bailout. Please.
I'm just saying some of that money could have funded a whole bunch of UBI. So
yeah,
some of that money could have refurbished an entire school system in this country.
Mm. But a lot of when you want to get down to the nuts and the bolts of the how would we fund it, one of the main ideas, and I'm borrowing this from Andrew Yang, is the establishment of a VAT tax, mm-hmm. a value added tax, and looking at some of our technology corporations like mm-hmm. Amazon and Google, who make billions, almost trillions of dollars. You know how much they paid in taxes last year?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
$0.
Yeah.
And they tried to come to New York with that shit too. They were like, give us a whole bunch of tax breaks and pay for us to come to your city while we also like rob your city blind and make everyone go bankrupt. Cool.
We could tax them at a 0.001% tax rate and fund UBI for like 20 years, for the entire country. So I am open to, innovative approaches to value added taxes for some of these organizations and corporations who are benefiting off the backs of those of us who are sitting around now trying to figure out if they're going to give us a couple more scraps of stimulus payments from this, from this fallout from the pandemic. And I would like to say, when you talked about Andrew and how Andrew's idea was about not necessarily, even if he didn't win, that his ideas, got put forward.
Mm-hmm.
When we were at the Detroit debate and he mentioned UBI.
I remember that clip.
Him off the stage. Kamala looked at him and laughed.
Pete Buttigieg
looked at him and laughed. I was in Detroit. I don't know if y'all heard me in the crowd.
Oh,
I'm
no.
I was like, Andrew.
Yeah.
I was in Amen Corner, Mm-hmm. And where are we now? They laughed at him. They thought it's a gimmick. He's just trying to buy votes, mm-hmm. et cetera, et cetera. And then the pandemic hit, right? And people started talking about stimulus payments, and guess who they started calling? Hey, what was that program that you phone blowing up? And the thing about it was, Andrew is the type of dude. Andrew's just like an awesome human being. Let me just say that. He is my friend and I love him dearly, and his family, Christopher, Damien, Evelyn, love all of it. But Andrew is like one of these dudes that is so rare, just in his humanity and just in his person, that you can't help but want to support and be around him. Like, he just like makes you better when you're around him as a human being. And so I treasure that we were able to not only meet, but develop a friendship out of that. He's just a great person in general. And so his thing, and he's kind of that by accident. It's like he's not even trying. It's like, hey, this is just, whatever it is, it's cool, let's hang out and just let it flow. And I'm like, Andrew, did you see what he said? Yeah, it's cool, whatever, it's cool. That's his mantra, whatever, it's cool. I'm like, it's not cool, but okay.
Your definition of cool and my definition of cool are two different things, but okay.
Yeah, watching and sort of modeling after him, kind of this idea, but they laughed and then they called him.
Yeah,
the day after Andrew suspended his campaign, he went right into, the ideas and the policies I want implemented don't stop. Just because I was trying to do them because I felt like they needed to be done on a national scale. And so I ran for the presidency. But I'm not going to stop trying to implement them just because I didn't get the presidency. So what'd he do? A month later, he opens Humanity Forward, a nonprofit. Right. And what do they start doing? Giving out grants, UBI, small little grants to people to help with the pandemic. So when the mm-hmm. pandemic, hit, he already even had an infrastructure in place of giving money away to people. And, I was hoping to give away some of the grants on social media. And so they called him and now they wanted to know. And those very first stimulus payments we got were like for $1,200 a month. Mm-hmm. And I believe that it was Andrew Yang's idea and talk around $1,000 a month that even informed them on where to start in terms of how much to make those stimulus payments be. Because I remember some years ago, we got like some little tax rebate or whatever from Bush back in the 90s, or like $300 or something like that, or $500. Right. So when the pandemic hit, I'm sure they were thinking about, oh, we might have to do one of those stimulus packages again. I think them cheap folks would have tried to, you know, go get away with $300 or $400. Yeah. But the conversation started at $1,000 and ultimately went to $1,200. But that we considered a win. You know, so Andrew won. And here we are today. Now he's running for mayor and talking about establishing a pilot of basic income in New York,
which we are so excited about. We are so on board and ready to help out with that.
So that's where I'm at in my thinking about it, too. It's about advancing these policies, about getting these ideas into the conversation, and about giving people back ownership over their future and ownership over politics, and getting them involved and getting them to trust that they have a voice and that their vote can count. If you look at the miracle that Stacey Abrams was able to pull off down in Georgia, I stand her.
I stand her all day.
Can we just clone her a couple times and spread her around the country?
But think about it. They took the governorship away from that woman. You know, they cheated her, they suppressed and gerrymandered and all this other kind of stuff to keep her out of the governor's ship. And she could have just, you know, taken her cards and went home. She's like, that's all right. You took the governorship from me, but I'm going to take the state. Yeah. And then, you know, they took the state and then they kind of turned around and she took the Senate seat. And now I hear she's maybe going to run for governor again in 2022. Yeah. They might as well.
She does. I hope she does. If she does, I swear to God, I'm going to go down to Georgia and make sure I'm knocking on all these doors. Yeah. Okay, but like, let's be sure. You voting for Abrams this time, right? Right.
But you know what she did in those 2 years was, okay, y'all want to do me like that? Fine. Mm-hmm. I'm going to go out and launch an advocacy and education campaign going into communities where people weren't as engaged and talking to them and convincing them that if they come and vote, we can change Georgia. And they trusted her. They came and voted and they changed Georgia.
Yep.
Amazing.
And they did that in Michigan too.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes people just need to be reminded of the power that they have. They need to be reminded so that they can hope again. And so that's a part of what's driving me here in D.C. Because like I said, turnout has been dismal. In the last midterm election, 2018, turnout was 18%. You know, so you're talking about 593,000 eligible registered voters in the city. 89,000 of them voted. Like,
it's similar in New York City. And I think a big part of that problem is when you have, you know, an area that isn't competitive. The less competitive something is, the less involved people get. And the more people kind of just say, oh, whatever's happening is happening and there's no reason for me to get involved. So that's why these competitive elections are so important. What, do you have a goal for turnout? Do you have you set like a numbers goal? Or it's like, if you can get turnout to this number, then you would be excited?
I'd love to double it. I mean, our ultimate goal would be to double it. But because our, you know, part of our strategy, and I hope they ain't looking, but you know, part of our strategy is like, we If 89,000 people voted, we need to knock on 189,000 doors.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Right.
We need to double our efforts in terms of canvassing and knocking on votes so that we make for the possibility of some of those people coming out and if it balances out. But realistically, in looking back over the history, because we looked at the numbers all the way back to when Eleanor first ran, and they've been consistently kind of decreasing. But I think the highest turnout in a primary has been maybe around 23-24%. And that was around the Obama years.
Okay. Amazing. So turnout is a big thing, getting people out and reminding them that they need to be involved in the process and that there's a reason to. You know, all these issues are so important and that they should have a voice in Congress that's representing that. That's amazing.
And that's the thing, you know, and it's even not just about registration, because, you know, a lot of times we focus a lot on getting voters registered. Our folks are registered. You know, one thing DC, you know, we don't understand it, you know, so we are registered. You know, like I said, we have 8 wards here in DC, and you probably got 60-70% registered voters in each ward has about 100,000 folks in it, roughly. And you got about 60-70% registration. They just don't come out.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. That's amazing. So they need somebody inspiring like you on the ticket, and hopefully that'll change it. That is amazing.
I launched my campaign publicly. I made the announcement on, you know, kind of online back on December the 8th. And then last month, January, I did a public event, you know, to kind of do the public launch. And so I've been on you know, campaign trail for about 2 months, you know, okay. 2 months. But it has been an incredible, I can't tell you, because one of the things, one of my prayers to God was, okay, if I do this, you know, bring the people, like, you know, I can't do this by myself. Like, right. I would need the expertise and the folks that are willing to help support. And it has been amazing how many people just have come forward with their different skill sets and gifts. Like, I'll do graphics for you.
Nice.
And I'll do political research, and I can write education policy, and I can, and nobody wants any money. And then, you know, I'm like, what?
Okay. That's amazing. You
know, okay.
How is Humanity Forward? Have they been involved in any way with your campaign? Have they been an asset to you, Humanity Forward?
Not directly, you know, because they're doing, you know, something separate. I'm going to apply for their endorsement because they do have an endorsement mechanism, mm-hmm. and they, you know, have given endorsements they did in the previous cycle. And I hope to apply for the one for this year, because what Humanity Forward will then do, if you do receive their endorsement, then they do provide text banking and phone banking support, right. and, you know, and some financial support. So I will most certainly, you know, seek that out. They haven't started that process yet.
Okay.
So, and still then early. Of course, Andrew, you know, he's had to kind of separate himself from the nonprofit, right. to do, you know, to do his candidacy. And, but, you know, he's, you know, he's always been very supportive of me. That's my dog. So, you know, he was one of the first people that, you know, when I started thinking about this, I'm like, what you think? You know, he's like, oh, go for it. You know, I got yes. you. You know? So I really appreciated, you know, him kind of giving me that, you know,
nice.
Do it. I think you'd be great. So
nice.
Yeah.
Nice. If people are inspired by your message and want to get involved, what's the number one thing people can do to help out?
Well, of course we need money. You know, I'm not one asking for money is not easy for me sometimes, because it's like, I don't ever want to feel like I'm a burden. And especially now when folks is like trying to figure out which bill are they going to pay and which one's going to wait. And, you know, but at the same time, we need these monies so that we can buy, you know, our materials, like hand out our palm cards. You know, we're about to ramp up now and start doing some canvassing. You know, we've been able to purchase some things, but I also will say, and I had posted this article the other day, that with the social media sites banning a lot of political advertising, it mm-hmm. has hindered the fundraising efforts that, you know, traditionally right. can would do.
Oh, and wow. Because so much of that advertising was around fundraising.
Yeah, think right. about that. Think about how many times you got inundated with ads on Facebook, on Twitter, and stuff like mm-hmm. that for people to raise money. And when they, you know, Trump ruined it for everybody. But, right. you know, but when they, in so many ways, but when they decided, when they decided to put those bans on political ads, they have yet to really lift them. I mean, some said they were going to do it through the Georgia runoffs, and then it became, we're going to wait till after inauguration. But we have sought, you know, Twitter's like not thinking about going back at all, because they're now saying that from their philosophy, they feel like candidates, you need to earn your donations and stuff like that, not be able to just buy it, which I get right. that. And I love Jack Dorsey, because UBI is close to his heart, and he set aside right. $5 billion of his money, and he's funding UBI projects all over the country. So I, you know, big ups to Jack, but it has hindered. And so Politico did this article about how it's already hindering 2022 campaigns. And some campaigns have had to fold or flop, because that was one of the primary ways of fundraising. So we're having to get creative about the ways that we raise funds. And so
that makes sense.
Please visit RevWendyForCongress.com, click donate, and
awesome.
$1, $5. We even love recurring donors. And the Yang Gang has been amazing. Let me just tell you about my family, because they are just, I love them. You know, they kind of, sort of nominated me. I mean, because I was sort of the spiritual and cultural advisor for Andrew, I kind of became that de facto for the Yang Gang.
Yes.
And so a lot of times I would lead different prayers and things like that during the campaign. You know, I do these Twitter live things and, you know, counsel folks and, you know, get folks in my DM doing little pastoral care and things like that. So they have been incredibly supportive of me. And a lot of them are all over the country. You know, I looked at our donations a couple weeks ago and we had received a donation from at least 35 different states around the country.
Okay, you know, that's what I like to hear.
Yeah. Alaska checked in with, you know, I was like,
that's amazing.
Yay, Alaska. You know?
That's great that people all across the country are already hearing your name and already getting enough of a recognition of your name to be like, oh, yeah, I'm about this. I'm going to go ahead and donate. Even if someone in Alaska, they aren't going to be really affected on a daily basis by DC being a statehood, but they obviously believe that you are the right person to lead this charge.
All right. So, you know, $5 donation, $10 donation. And I said it even today. I said, you know, I appreciate that because I know what people are going through right now. And I know that they have other obligations financially that they need to meet. So the fact that you took $5 or $10 out of those obligations because you wanted to contribute to my campaign means the world to me. And I see you and I appreciate you because I know that's a sacrifice that you're making right now. So I appreciate it.
It's tough out there right now, but in supporting these issues and enabling people like yourself to be able to make these issues heard is so important. And that's why people around the country care about what you're doing. Because it's not just the fact that you're running for Congress and they want a voice like yours in Congress, but they want the issues that you are championing to get
that's
heard.
Exactly right.
And that's what we're funding here. You know, and then that's why the Yang Gang and Andrew has really spread this message so well and built this whole movement of people who now believe in these issues. And when they see people like yourself who are championing them, that we want to get behind that and we want to support that. So we really are so excited to see what you're doing and to help spread this message. We hope to be able to interview you again further down the road as we're getting
once
closer.
You get to be part of the squad.
Yes. So exciting.
Well, I'm always open to interviews and you know, and another way, you know, of course, like I said, money can help, but you know, a lot of people that do support me remotely, let me also say this, you know, you can help even right now, because I said the number one sort of obstacle or challenge I have is name recognition and getting my name out there. So, you know, what we've been encouraging some of our volunteers to do that are online, you know, if you happen to be on the DC, the Washington Post or, you know, some of these DC based sites and things like that, mention my name. You know, I have a couple of volunteers, you know, that have gone on there. I mean, be respectful, but you know, I think the DC City Council had, you know, had posted something and they were talking about the budget issue. And I saw a volunteer, Reverend Wendy has a great UBI policy that would address some of these budget shortcomings. And
they
ain't going to come with data, right? They're not just going to be like, vote for me. They're like, no, if you apply a VAT tax, it's going to help, you know, reduce the budget by this amount.
The empirical data shows.
You know, and I love it. You know, I love their energy and their enthusiasm and their support. And so those are other ways. If you have family in DC, you know, because at the end of the day, yes, I love the international, the national support and folks from all around the country, you know, bringing their efforts, but they can't vote for me.
Correct.
The DC voters are the ones that have to vote for me. And that's who I have to get my name in front of. And that's who I have to get my message in front of, because that's who's going to put me in office. And so I tell folks, if you got an uncle, cousin, anybody that you know that can talk to a DC voter and direct them to our website or something like that, do that, because that's ultimately who's going to make the difference for me in this race as well.
Will you be doing invitations for people to come to DC and knock on doors for you? Is that something that is down the road?
Absolutely. And because as I mentioned, what the key is going to be is turnout. And so as we start to lift some of the pandemic restrictions, because we're still in the midst of that, especially here in DC. So not doing a lot of door to door, still doing a lot of Zoom and, you know, little small group things. But as we get closer to the spring, you know, they're talking about the vaccine now being more widely available, maybe everybody being available to get it in April. Mm-hmm. That's when we'll start looking at doing some more on the ground canvassing and door knocking. But my plan is by the time we get to January, because the primary is not till 2022, right?
Right.
Right.
June of 2022. So we got about 14 months. Head Start. But if I spend the rest of this year pounding home my message, getting to know people, talking to the voters, I plan in January to stage the biggest get out the vote, you know, campaign that you have ever seen. Because like I said, at the end of the day, it's getting the people out the house to the polls.
Amazing.
And so whatever strategy starting in January that we need to work out so that by the time early voting starts in you know, May, because we have early voting in DC, that we are helping to get out the vote.
Well, we would love to help be involved in that process. So please consider us on board and you know, we'll exchange contact information. So let us know. And I'm sure we're going to see it on social media. I'd love to come down to DC and be involved in some door knocking. That sounds like a lot of fun. And even inspiring more, you know, people from our audience and other parts of the Yang Gang to hear about your message and to get inspired to come and get involved if they can.
Well, that's what I love. I mean, they're already saying it like, I'm coming, you know, just, you know, waiting on the, you know, the go ahead to do it, but they're ready. They're standing by. And again, yes, it's because they support me, but they also support the policies and as DC goes, so goes the rest of the country, you know? Yeah. And so they're all like, I've got an army that'll be willing to get on the ground and knock on. I'm looking forward to it. And thank you guys. Thank you for today. Thank you for the platform and the opportunity.
Our absolute pleasure.
To talk with you all. It's been a blessing. It always also helps me to stay fresh on my stump speech. And
Well, you're killing it. You bring such joy to this race, and we're so inspired to get to talk to you and to hear your message and to share it with our audience. Mm-hmm. And we can't wait to follow more of your campaign over the next year and 15 months or however long 14 months until June.
Yeah.
And to be involved in you know, getting people out to help out with that as well. So absolutely. We look forward to sharing the next year, you know, from the sidelines and helping out wherever we can.
Now, were you going to show the ad, or did you pull the ad up?
Well, what we're going to do is, because we're not doing this live, we're going to actually edit it in so that it just plays in the whole thing.
We'll play it right at the end. We'll run that right now is what people are going to see.
But I'm also really excited because one of my friends who I play D&D with, which I'm going to be doing in about 90 minutes, is actually in DC. So I'm really excited because I get to tell a DC voter all about my interview with
happening.
You. And I'm going to be like, all right, so now you need to go tell all of your friends, go tell your wife, go tell your wife's friends.
Tell your wife. Yep. That's how we're going to do this thing. That's how we're going to do this thing. We're going to go person to person, ward to ward, you know, kitchen table to kitchen table. I'm going to leave it all on the floor at the end of the day.
We're going to need to get you one of those pairs of AOC's shoes. Did you see that? She went through like 30 pairs of shoes in her campaign.
Her and Stacey Abrams, they both burned through so many shoes just knocking on doors.
Yeah, no, I didn't see that, but I believe it. And I feel that, you know, and so I absolutely plan to do that because at the end of the day, like I said, I want to, you know, win or lose per se, I want to feel good about the effort that we put forward. At the end of the day, it's up to the voters to decide.
Yeah.
But it won't be because we didn't give it all that we had.
Right. Amen. Amen.
Right.
Reverend Wendy Hamilton, thank you so much for your time and for your inspiration.
Absolutely.
All right. Appreciate you all. Take care of yourselves and let's go win 2022.
Yes.
Best of luck to you. We'll be in touch.
Have a wonderful day. We'll talk to you soon.
Okay. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
My name is Reverend Wendy Hamilton. I'm running to represent Washington, D.C. in Congress as its delegate.
The rest of the country looks at D.C. and they see Washington. They see power, but they don't know D.C. They don't know our power, the power of all our people. We believe that D.C. statehood is possible, that D.C. can govern itself, that health care is a right, and that universal basic income is essential. Every D.C. resident can thrive. We believe in D.C.
Join me